welcome to the Silent London Toute la Mémoire du Monde podcast, part deux. And if you thought I couldn't drop highbrow movie references into this thing, you was clearly mistaken. So today was quite a short day, but I'm going to try and recap it before we move on to the weekend. Simply put, today I indulged myself by watching three musicals back to back. Two of them have a lot in common. One of them is different from them and pretty much from every other musical I've ever seen. So I'd like to take them out of order, and I'm going to talk first about The King of Jazz. If you listen to this podcast, if you read the blog, Silent London blog, that is, silentlondon.co.uk, I feel I should somehow promote that, you may well have already seen The King of Jazz. I'm a little bit late to the party. It showed at Bologna, it showed at the London Film Festival, I think. It's done the rounds, but it was worth the wait for me. I was told it was something I had to watch. It's a Universal musical. It's from 1930. It's an early two-strip Technicolor film, and it's a very early musical. In fact, so I think it took a long time to be made, and it was made in several different language versions and all this sort of thing that made it quite a big production. But what you get in the end is a very, very strange film indeed. There really are no words for The King of Jazz. You could say, you know, WTF, but that would stand for Wacky Technicolor Freakout, I think. It's effectively a stage show put on screen and done in a very elaborate way. So there are fantastically elaborate musical numbers. There are some great performers here. You know, we've got Bing Crosby, I think it's his first appearance on film, is one of the singers, and John Bowles, and you know, Paul Whiteman himself and his troupe. Not that they actually get named as such. Laura LaPlante, a lot of you will know from her silent comedy, she performs some skits, and there's really some very, very impressive stuff in here. It's slightly unfair to say that the two-strip Technicolor grates, and I think it grates much earlier than in a more naturalistic film, just because it seems to be set up for some kind of kaleidoscopic display, and all you've got is red and green, and that's it. The skin tones look fairly natural, but everything else, your eyes seem to crave a wider variety of colour. And there is another point about colour, in that Paul Whiteman may be quite well named. It's an incredibly white production, particularly this is shown up because of the emphasis on jazz in the title and throughout the whole thing, and the history of jazz. Every so often they'll make a reference to the history of jazz, and they'll talk about jazz coming from the heart of Africa originally, which, you know, jazz historians can talk about that. But there's a closing number in which really I think is maybe intended to talk about the melting pot of America, because it has all these dances representing people from around the world, but mostly, well, almost entirely, I think, Europe and Russia. And they all go into Paul Whiteman's melting pot of jazz and come out as American jazz. And I really, you know, I think we can all agree that's not quite how American jazz was made, although, I'm sure all the Cossack dancers and bagpipers are having a great time of it. Bing Crosby, as I said, is in it, and, you know, the performers are generally very adept, although some of the humour and the styles of music will seem quite old-fashioned, if not just plain ludicrous. You know, we have this, have a very stagey number about a bridal dress, about a bride imagining her wedding day and thinking about all the women that have worn bridal dresses before her, and it all seems very, very Victorian. And then, you know, you sort of have a more upbeat number, like Happy Feet, which works. It works. It sounds great, but it's hard to reconcile the two. And I think I think the intention was to sort of have something for everyone, a sort of cross-generational appeal. It all seems quite abrupt. It's interesting as an early sound film and as an early Technicolor film. It's actually quite dazzling to watch. There were times when I thought it was absolutely splendid, and there were times when I was just begging for it to end, really, sort of internally just hoping that it would all be over, because I was finding it a little bit oppressive in many ways. It really is something to see, and if you're interested in this period of history, then I think it's, you know, it's probably quite crucial that you grab a screening of it. I know also, I've had a look at this, there's the amazing book about the restoration, about the film and about the restoration by David Pearce and James Layton that you can pick up or, you know, leaf through a library, because it's really quite a monster. It was a very elaborate production. I think on my screening notes for the Cinematheque screening tonight said something about Bela Lugosi being in it, and I think he was the MC for it in the Hungarian language version, which is now lost. And it went through all these different versions before it came out, and it's definitely an exercise in film history rather than, you know, maybe an afternoon at the pictures. At the screening that I attended, the introduction said something like, and again, I'm translating from French and through my sleepy memory, something about, you know, showing a film like this at an event like this is a time, perfect time for people to respect the technique of its production and also the technique of, it sounded like replication. I think he means the restoration, trying to restore the two-strip Technicolor to the black and white print that they had. So it seems a bit childish to quibble with the fact that Paul Whiteman has a very interesting approach to jazz, not one that you or I might recognise, but it's an unforgettable film, that's for sure. And I just need to tell you my favourite fact about Paul Whiteman, which I always forget and remember and forget and remember. You all know Margaret Livingston, silent film actress. If her name doesn't immediately ring a bell, then you have to remember the woman from the city in Sunrise. Yeah, he married her. So she married the king of jazz, and if you can't also picture Paul Whiteman, I'm going to suggest to you a very, very, very rotund man with a rather large second chin and a tiny, weeny wire moustache and slicked back hair. And I don't really picture them together, but that happened. So that was my final screening of the day, actually. Early in the afternoon, I'd had a double bill of two CinemaScope musicals because I knew it was going to be better for me than Forbidden Planet. You may well wonder what I was doing, indulging myself all afternoon, watching two CinemaScope musicals, when I, you know, could have been reading my books on silent film or going to see some silent films. Well, I felt it was my duty, after having started the CinemaScope strand with something that I didn't enjoy, to see something better. Oh, that's not true at all. I love musicals. But, you know, I am not, and I never have been, a purist. So when you've seen a film, but you've only seen it on TV, you know, I think it's fair enough to say you've seen it. But I knew that watching these 35mm prints in the full CinemaScope ratio was going to be the real experience, the true experience of seeing these musicals. And this way I was able to compare them. And I do that selflessly for you. I'm sure you appreciate that. I think it's fair to say that far and away my favourite of the two films was It's Always Fairweather. They're both from 1954-1955, both directed by Stanley Donen, although It's Always Fairweather is co-directed by Gene Kelly. If The King of Jazz is the start of the musical, you know, the very early beginnings of the musical, then I think that you could say that these two films represent something of the last gasp of its golden age. You know, better things were to come, maybe, you might argue, but these are sort of two late films from the Freed unit at MGM. So It's Always Fairweather has been called something of a cynical musical, and it's got a very downbeat theme. It's about friendship, about how friendship can fail, really. So it's about three mates who come out of the army and swear they'll always be pals, and they'll meet up again in 10 years' time and continue their friendship. Of course, they do meet up, but they realise that they've all changed. They've let themselves down. They aren't the men that they dreamed of becoming, and that's particularly Gene Kelly's problem. And they've got certain aspects of their life they're embarrassed about, and they can't bear each other. So it's not really initially what you would think you would use Eastman Colour and CinemaScope for. In fact, a lot of the time the CinemaScope frame is being used just to showcase that there are three of them, and they're so different, so you've almost got triptychs. Where the CinemaScope and the Eastman Colour and the fact that Gene Kelly is involved with Stanley Donen is in the dance routines. And really, you know, this does show here something of the benefit of that wider frame. For all the movement, for all the dancers, particularly impressive drunk ballet at the beginning of this film, where the three boys are
dancing around New York, tipsy as you like, and there's a whole complicated number with a taxi cab, and then with some dustbin lids. It's absolutely virtuoso stuff, and they fill every corner of the frame. So, I mean, it does look great. The other thing that It's Always Fair Weather shows you can be done with the CinemaScope frame is fighting. And there is some brilliantly choreographed slapstick and fighting in this film. The slapstick routine that really shines in this film is by Dan Daly playing the small, slightly more upper class character of the three boys, who is an advertising executive, but you know he wanted to become a painter, and he's realising that his careerist life is a bit of a sham, so he gets drunk at a big fancy works dinner party and behaves abominably, and it's the sort of thing that can get a bit tiresome, but it's amazingly, it's just note perfect. And then the whole film sort of really culminates in a massive fight sequence, which is quite well, you know, we always want to say these things are like dance. We'll see that later in the next film. This one is just great fight. And we've had a lot of boxing and things like that. You've got to remember there are some, that it's not just Gene Kelly, it's Dan Daly, as I said, and also Michael Kidd as Angie Valentine, the sort of little one of the group. Sid Charisse is in it, and she plays this amazing sort of smart career woman, but sort of hard bitten, who has her sights set on Gene Kelly. And Dolores Gray has a brilliant sort of cameo, slightly more than a cameo, as a TV presenter. And that's one of the reasons why the film has a sort of sharp edge, I think, is quite a lot of it is involved with the satire of TV. TV obviously being something that was threatening the dominance of Hollywood and big studios like MGM. And they are throwing quite a lot at pointing out how shallow and shabby TV can be. As you and I know, TV is amazing. So, you know, they've shot themselves in the foot with that one. Yeah, so the singing and dancing is great. The story carries you along. It's funny. It's really funny. People in my screening were just hooting with laughter. And even I did notice some people singing along. It's exactly what I want from a musical. It is not the best use of CinemaScope for a musical that I saw today. So first, a couple of words about what it was like to watch these two 35mm prints this afternoon at Tout-le-Moment du Monde. First off, we were in this fantastic cinema, the Filmotheque in the Latin Quarter, which really, it's a bit small and cosy, but it does look exactly like a picture house looks in the movies. Little red box, ornate fittings, lots of people rowing about where was the best place to sit, which I found quite entertaining, except when I somehow almost got embroiled in an altercation between two cinephiles. But, you know, apart from that, delightful. The prints that we watched, you could definitely tell it was film. They looked lively. They also looked like they'd lived a bit of a life. You know, you really could tell the texture of the film was there and some of the wear, but you also got particularly vivid colours. Now, they weren't in the greatest shape, but you wouldn't be after all that time. Also, because I was watching it at this festival, I had French subtitles, and I'm not trying to say that I instantly followed the English talking dialogue and translated the subtitles straight away, but you could tell a difference sometimes, and particularly whoever had subtitled It's Always Fair Weather had really gone to town and had a completely different set of jokes that worked in French, not in English. And at one point, you know, when Dolores Gray was singing, there was a joke about John Wayne that they'd translated into a joke about Charlemagne. So really, I had to say, building up to my viewing of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, this was that great way to watch the film. I was feeling very, very jolly. And yes, I liked Seven Brides for Seven Brothers today far more than I ever have done in the past. And I'd argue it is a brilliant example of a CinemaScope film. So first off, you've got the basic premise of the film, which we all hate. It's all vile, the whole thing about the sobbing women and the, you know, sobbing fit to be tied, and the idea that you get your wife by kidnapping or bartering for them. Well, the film doesn't really care about that. I still do a little bit, but the film sort of keeps having people point out that that's wrong, and it just doesn't care, it just carries on. The main thing about the premise here is that when you have seven brides and seven brothers, you've got pretty much 14 leads, and that is exactly what you need to fill a CinemaScope frame. So this one isn't shot in Eastman colour, it's shot in Ansco colour, and I'm going to say know nothing about that, but obviously it's a very vivid, brightly coloured musical. You've got beautiful pastoral backdrops. They go through all the seasons. Each of the brothers wears a different colour shirt. The women are always changing their clothes. You know, they do everything they can to make this film live up to the format. And I think the main thing is the choreography, which is by Michael Kidd, and it's really very unusual. They incorporate lots of activities that people on farms up in the mountains in Oregon, you know, might have done. So there's a sad song that the boys sing while they're sawing wood and things like that. And there's obviously the most famous sequence of all is the barn raising. And this, to me, takes what we saw in It's Always Fair Weather to another level. Both the dance sequence, where you've got the six women and the six men and the six rival men all swapping partners and going between each other and dancing in unison. It's amazing and shot beautifully to fill the frame. And then it turns into this slapstick sequence, which is the fight. And it's a fight on a building site. I mean, it's like Lauren Hardy's greatest dream come true. And there's heaps of them. Everything's going on at once. You actually see some of the same moves as in the fight sequence from It's Always Fair Weather. I highly, highly recommend going to see this film with the pictures. I don't think the songs are that great. I really hate the plot. Howard Keel is very dashing. June Powell is absolutely delightful. But this is exactly what CinemaScope is for. And I can't spend an entire podcast talking about musicals without pointing out that in both films, the most successful uses of this wider frame are, you know, the drunk ballet in It's Always Fair Weather and the barn raising scene in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. And it's, you know, the wordless sequences, the dialogue-free spectacle cinema. You know, I wish that The King of Jazz had had all this colour and all this frame. I wish it had all this life rather than feeling that it had to be static because it was nearly talky. I wish that we could see more silent films using this kind of space, which obviously brings me back to the Apple Guns screening that I saw on the first night of the festival. I'm really getting drawn into the CinemaScope strand now. I mean, obviously, because, you know, I've mostly enjoyed the films. I even enjoyed the film that I thought wasn't very good. It's going to be fascinating to see how different filmmakers use that space. If I get to see any more of them, I will look forward to that. I really only want to see musicals now. Musicals and slapstick comedy forever. But that's not really too bad of a life. I'm going to have to look at the schedule for Saturday now and see what I can do about that. Thank you so much for listening. Watch more musicals, watch more silent films, and come back for another instalment.
You mean men are learning how to dance?
Uh-huh. Yes, they came direct from Paris.